In this session, we're going to be discussing not just the Brohl Place treatment of homosexuals in the Orthodox community, but specifically a statement of principles on the place of Jews with a homosexual orientation in the Orthodox community, a statement of principles that you'll find on the tables in front of you that was released this past summer. The driving force behind the statement, to my right, Rabbi Nadi Helfcott. Rabbi Helfcott is the chair of the Tanakh and Jewish Thought Departments at Yeshivat Chov Beit Torah, and is a graduate from YU, has received a master's degree in education from Israeli Graduate School of Yeshiva University, and was ordained there in 1989. He studied extensively in Israel, including his last session, which he spoke about, his relationship with Professor Nechama Leibowitz. To my left, Rabbi Dr. Barry Freundel, who's the spiritual leader of Kesher Israel, the Georgetown Synagogue in Washington, D.C., who received a smicha from Yeshiva University, his Ph.D. from Baltimore Hebrew University. And pertaining to this particular session, he published Homosexuality and Halakha in 1986. We wanted to get these gentlemen together to discuss the statement of principles and the very serious issues that arise from it, that emerge from it. The structure of the session will be that Rabbi Helfcott will present some opening remarks for a few moments, and Rabbi Freundel will respond briefly, and then we'll begin a back and forth discussion. Rabbi Helfcott.
Thank you, Dr. Malamud. It's wonderful to be here again at the Torah Motion, which addresses some of the serious issues and questions of the day in our Orthodox community. I just want to give a little bit of background to the statement. You have it in front of you. I'm sure most of you who decided to come to this session have read it before. I know for sure some people have read it before because they talked to me about it. So I'd like to give a little bit of background, why it was written, and then we can talk more about it as the session progresses. I've been in Chinuch for 25 years, the world of Jewish education, on many different levels. And over the years, of course, anyone who's been in Chinuch and seriously engaging with people, whether on a formal level or informal level, knows that the issue of kids, adults, coming out and homosexuality has become a major topic both in the general society of America, Canada, Europe, Israel, and specifically in our Jewish society. And it's taken many different forms. Specifically in our communities, anyone who's been in Chinuch or Rabbanus, etc., has engaged with families, students, who after they go off to college come out and identify as homosexual or have struggles with homosexual orientation. Many of us have had friends. Some of us have had relatives who've come out to us. And the tension, of course, is on the one hand to express human sympathy and appreciation of the difficulty that they're struggling with in terms of, on the one hand, wanting to be part of the traditional Jewish community, which values so much correctly family, procreation, marriage, etc. On the other hand, people who don't feel that they can in any way, shape, or form fit into that kind of idyllic picture. And over the years, all of us have experienced more and more friends, family, relatives, people that we know who've expressed their feelings of suffering, their feelings of pain, their feelings of alienation, and the desire to find some way to be part of the Jewish community, part of the Orthodox community, and yet how can they live within that? Now, over the years, many of us, friends of mine, Mechanchim, have had conversations about these issues, but it never really came to anything. Last year, Yeshiva University, not Yeshiva University itself, but a student group in Yeshiva University, together with Wurzweiler School of Social Work, decided to sponsor a panel in which became very famous, of course, on YouTube and everywhere else, on the internet, decided to sponsor a panel about being gay in the Orthodox community. And they had a number of students speak about their experience, either current students or former students, alumni, speak about their experience and the suffering and the pain and the alienation and the problems. On the one hand, of wanting to be part of the community. On the other hand, obviously not fitting in, and how they talk to their parents, how they talk to their friends. And, of course, that was a very big watershed moment within the Orthodox community. But more specifically, because of the reaction. There were numerous reactions to that event. A number of very prominent voices within the Orthodox community came out with some very, very harsh rhetoric about how people who are gay or homosexual in their orientation should discuss their reality in public, or whether they should at all talk about it in public. People spoke about the issue of reparative therapy as a kind of absolute default position that everyone should first try. I hope everyone knows what I'm talking about. I'm not going to go into details. And many of us, friends, mechanchim, rabbis, were very taken aback, because that became presented as the exclusive Orthodox voice on the question of how one deals with the reality of individuals who are part of the Orthodox community or want to be part of those community and yet are homosexual in their orientation. And we felt it was important to not simply react viscerally, and therefore we did not issue any statement at the time. But a group of friends got together and started brainstorming about writing something concrete, thoughtful, balanced, nuanced, over the course of, and hopefully share it with the rabbinic community and eventually with the general community. And so I started to draft a skeleton document, which I shared with very good friends. Indeed, this final document is the product not only of Nadi Helfgott, but also of two other great educators, Rabbi Yitzi Blau in Israel, who's the Rosh Kolel of Yeshivat Shvilei HaTorah, and Rabbi Aryeh Klapper, who's the head of the Summer Beit Midrash in Boston. And we shared it with a lot of people, educators, from psychologists, Rosh Yeshiva, Mechanchim, many of whom gave wonderful input, even if in the end they chose not to sign it because of political reasons, because they disagreed with this comma or this word. It happens. No one is forced to sign anything, and I understand that fully. And we shared it with real, what I consider Gedolei Yisrael also, for their input and for their evaluation. And we all got very, I think, excellent input. Finally, we decided at a certain point, you know, you can keep going over a document till you can never. And then when we felt all comfortable with that the document was balanced and nuanced, we published it this summer. The document, which is in front of you and many of you have read already, tries to strike a balance between our unassailable, unwavering commitment to the halachic proscription and prohibition on homosexual behavior, sexual behavior, which is absolutely forbidden, and the document makes that very clear, while at the same time balancing our desire to rid our community of, God forbid, the shaming of people or the embarrassment of people or treating people without dignity and not respecting their tzelem Elohim and their human autonomy and agency. And so this document tries to strike that balance. I hope, you know, it's not Torah Misinai, it's not perfect, but it's an attempt to try to strike that balance of not, on the one hand, affirming the clear-cut prohibitions of halacha, at the same time affirming the clear-cut other prohibitions of halacha about shaming or demeaning another human being. And then the rest of the document tries to thread the needle about how as a community, how we as Orthodox Jews in a community committed to family, committed to the ideal of heterosexual marriage and procreation, and at the same time can make space for the percentage of our spouses, children, friends who are going to be and coming out, who are homosexual, who struggle and want to be part of the Jewish community and yet feel alienated. And we laid out a couple of suggestions, a couple of thoughts. As I said, we tried to be balanced and nuanced. We talked about some of the controversial issues about reparative therapy, where we said that we are not going to take the position. We said very clearly what the consensus of most mental health professionals is, and at the same, and the fact that reparative therapy is not effective. And at the same time, we didn't say that it should never be. If a person chooses to go under that, they can. But if a person chooses they don't want to, they shouldn't have to be. We talked about issues of synagogue, that synagogues, if they're inclusive of other people who are not necessarily Shomer Torah mitzvot 100%, then we have to make space for people who are also engaging in other behaviors that are not 100% halachic. If we really believe that's the kind of synagogue we have to. We left it up to the individual synagogue to ultimately decide, but that was the thrust that we were driving at. If we have a synagogue which is inclusive and we give aliyot to people who are not Shomer Shabbat, and we give aliyot to people who are a kohanim who are married to grushas, or other kind of issues that happens in many synagogues, then we have to find a way to include people who are not necessarily living up to all the standards of sexual morality that we hold dear. And basically, this is the purpose of the document. It's an attempt to balance different halachic and Jewish values, our devotion to family, to shmirat hamitzvot, to taharat hamishpacha, to sexual ethics, and at the same time our devotion to tzelem elokim, kvod habriyot, and all the isurim of not shaming someone. And that's basically the document. And I'm sure there are people who could quibble about this sentence or that sentence, many of whom did not choose to sign it, which is fine. But Baruch Hashem, 150 Orthodox rabbis, some very prominent, have chosen to sign it, and others as well. And others under the table have written me emails that I can't sign it for political reasons, but it's the correct way to go, etc., etc. So this is where we're at today, and thank you for your hakshava.
Thank you. Rabbi Refrendel, you'll now respond.
Again, thank you for inviting me. I've had a terrific weekend and met many of you in this room and many other people. It's fascinating to me to listen to Nati describe the process that he went through, because 24 years ago in 1986, I wrote the article on halakha and homosexuality and said pretty much the same thing that this document says. And like Nati, I didn't write the article myself. I discussed it with a number of people. I went through to a number of firm psychiatrists and psychologists. You know, I tried to verify whatever it was that I was saying, talked to a lot of people. My reason for writing it in 1986 was because in those days, really the only article out there on homosexuality and halakha was Dr. Lamb's. Dr. Lamb, who I'm very close to, I was his rabbinic assistant. He was my sort of second father, and I disagreed with him because I didn't like what he said. And in fact, asked him permission, and I think he's a great man in many ways. His response to me, I sent him a copy of it. I said, I won't publish this if you ask me not to because it disagrees with you. And his response was, Torah hi v'lumod ani chayav. It's Torah and I need to learn. And I thought that was just wonderful. So, and many of the same reactions that Nati describes, Rabbi Helfgott describes, were reactions that I had then. You know, I had people on the right who were telling me this is a terrible thing and you're supporting a toeva and all this kind of thing. But I understand the need. And there is, at the end of that article, an agenda for the Orthodox community. It's very similar, point by point, very similar. It focuses on this idea of if our synagogues are going to accept and do outreach to people who are not keeping Shabbos, there's no reason why we shouldn't be doing the same thing here. And the basic premise of the article was that homosexuality in halakha is an activity. It's not a state of being. There isn't even a term in halakha for homosexual. If you ask an Israeli, how do you say homosexual? They either say homosexual, which tells you there isn't a term, or they will say aliz, which is the translation of gay. In fact, in halakha, there's even an opinion, without being too graphic, that the different roles in homosexual activity fall under different prohibitions. So clearly, we never had a concept that this was a person. It doesn't define who you are as a person and all the rest. Nonetheless, I didn't sign this document. And I have to tell you, having had conversations over Shabbos with people here, I think if I lived in Canada, I probably would have. And so you'll say to me, what's the difference? Because I live in Washington, D.C., why is it different? Because you guys have gay marriage, and we don't. And I'll explain what I mean. When I wrote it in 1986, what the gay community was looking for was basic human acceptance. And I felt that halakha not only endorsed that, I felt it required that. I felt we were required to make a statement or to take a stance that said, in effect, look, these are human beings. They may be doing something. They may be engaging in activity that we consider to be wrong. But exactly as Rabbi Helfgott said, lots of people do things that are wrong. and we have to treat them the same, and it doesn't delegitimize anybody, and it doesn't allow for bashing, it doesn't allow that. Aside from which, that the definition of homosexuality, when you talk about a homosexual, doesn't include activity. It includes thoughts. It includes desires. And so if someone has desire for same gender but never does anything about it, they're still labeled homosexual, but not in halakha, right? It's not an issue. I made all these points. I felt it was very necessary. The problem that I saw here in an American context was that in 2009 or 2010, the issue on the table, state after state, is gay marriage. This document obviously does not endorse gay marriage, appropriately so, because halakha will not, nor did I. The problem is that my contacts in the gay community, who I developed because of the first article that I'd written, were not happy and were not pleased with this article or this statement of principles. Because frankly, not only didn't they feel that it went far enough, they felt it was pushing them back. One of them said to me, rather famously, "We were in the back of the bus. We're trying to move to the front of the bus. We have accomplished in America where we've gotten pretty much to the front, and this statement is putting us in the back to say, well, you know, you're human beings. But the question of whether we're human beings or not and should be treated with respect has long since passed in America. We've achieved that. We just haven't achieved everything. We haven't achieved the gay marriage thing." So I actually thought that making this a public statement, well, while it would be very good in certain segments of the modern Orthodox community, made people feel good, it gave validation, and I see many positives in the fact that there was a statement. And there are many communities where I think this was a necessary statement. And a few years before your statement, I spoke at the RCA on this subject, took the position that I've taken for 26 years or so, and I had one of the Rosh Yeshiva sitting next to me who said, no, we have to stigmatize gays. It's like intermarriage. And I looked at him like, what are you talking about? It's a completely different thing. It's a completely different phenomenon, right? You know, you're talking about something that comes internally that clearly is a strong desire. Why would you say that that's the same phenomenon? So I think in certain circles this is very good. But putting it out that way, I think, didn't accomplish, in America at least, what it should have accomplished. Because what you want a statement of principles to accomplish. Because as I say, the gay community didn't like it. It was a lot of, not the whole gay community, but there were significant portions of it that didn't like it, that really felt it was almost offensive in a sense. Certainly, the Haredi community didn't like it. And for the narrow sliver that it dealt with, I didn't think it was the right way to go. I would have actually much preferred if there had been a concerted effort to get the RCA and to get other organizations online to create guidelines, to create curricula, to bring this material to schools and synagogues within the community, to try and speak to the community that I think would be most responsive to it and most needed to hear it and would most appreciate it, rather than putting it out as a public thing. So it's a difference, and you could disagree with me. And as I say, if I lived in Canada where there is gay marriage, and that's not the fight here, and from what I understand from people around here, the basic acceptance issue is still an issue, for example, in the Toronto Jewish community, I might very well have signed this, or I might have worked hard to try and modify some of the nitty-gritty that I don't like. But as Nati Zeva Helfgott says, that's really not the critical issue as much as the question of strategy and tactics. So I have a disagreement on strategy. I don't have a disagreement fundamentally. I will point out, I could go through nitty-gritty things. I will take up just a couple of places where I have problems, and maybe in the conversations I will discuss some others. Real quick, in number four, the comment here makes, while halacha categorizes various homosexual acts with different degrees of severity and opprobrium, including toiva. Toiva is a very tricky term here, and in the article that I wrote, I tried to deal with it. Toiva does not create a separate category of halachic negativity. If you look at all the places where toiva appears, includes things like eating non-kosher, unethical business practices, and things like that. And as I wrote in the article many years ago, if you want to take all the Jews who've engaged in unethical business practices and stigmatize them the way we sometimes do with toiva and homosexuality, you're going to have a very empty shul. You know, like, who are you going to daven with, right, kind of thing. So I have trouble playing with that term this way. Again, that may be a little nitty-gritty, but I'll take one or two others that I think are a problem. You addressed the synagogue honors, which is a shul which is not which would not allow a Shomer Shabbos to have an aliyah. The same thing with someone who's engaged in homosexual activity. I don't think it reads that quite that way. But my last one and my biggest one, well, actually two more, the business of accepting members. I'm not sure what you mean by that. I've had many members of my synagogue who have been, again, I'll use their term. My term would be engaged in homosexual activity. I had a guy who davened Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur who did. He basically didn't tell anybody. In fact, my article served as the basis of the don't ask, don't tell policy of the U.S. military. It was read by the chiefs of staff of the United States. It was given to them by a fellow named Norman Podhoretz, who used to be the editor of Commentary, and that's the basis of the present Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in the United States, which may be overturned. I may lose my claim to fame, but for the moment, at least I'm famous in those circles for having done so. But are you talking about family memberships, or are you talking about individual members? Because I've had gay couples who've taken out two single memberships in the synagogue, but I wouldn't allow family memberships, and I think that raises some questions about where the orientation is. And the last one, and this is the biggest one, is in 11, full embrace of the adopted or biological children of homosexually active Jews. The question that hits me, because I'm also the head of the Gay Risk Committee for the RCA, as many of you know from last night, is, okay, a homosexual couple shows up an adopted kid. I don't even know what the answer would be as to whether we would convert a child in that setting. I'm not saying no, to tell you the truth, because if it's private and we don't really know what's going on, it's private activity. But if they were publicly gay, isn't that the same as not being Shomer Shabbos? We want to convert a child who's publicly not Shomer Shabbos. But this question hasn't been asked yet. We are, you know, it would be, I have to tell you, a huge conversation as to what to do. And this seems, at least, and you may not have meant it, to take a position, because it says you have to fully embrace the adopted children of homosexual couples. Now, you probably could tweak this, and maybe you agree with me on all the issues that I raise, and you could possibly get there. So maybe this is the nitty-gritty stuff, but I at least want to raise them. I go back to what I said. In the American context, I thought this was not the right strategy. I thought trying to create educational and rabbinic education and education of educators to try and get these principles in place was a better plan because of where the society is in America. I don't think I feel that way in Toronto because the gays are not fighting about gay marriage. It's been here for 10 years. It's not the on-the-cusp issue at the moment. So it may be different in different places. Thank you.
Okay. When this session was publicized, I started getting lots and lots of email of stuff that people wanted to raise. So I'm going to ask some questions here that are a kind of cross-section of things that people have raised. And I'm myself personally just rehearsing in many ways the sorts of feedback I've been getting. Probably the most common one and the most conventional one, which I know that you must have heard many times, is the notion that the Torah, on its face, already commands sensitivity to all human beings as a prime directive of Torah values. In the Torah, there's certain people who are specified as sort of marginalized or disenfranchised entities, and we all know who they are, the Ger, the Yatom, the Almanah. Why did you feel that a specific document, Rabbi Helfgott, was necessary to engender sensitivity to homosexuals? And I guess it's inevitable that a part B of that would be, do you feel that there's a problem, obviously, in treatment or attitudes to homosexuals in the Orthodox community such that the regular sort of ethical legislation of the Torah is insufficient to engender the kind of attitudes that you'd like to see?
Before I answer the question, you obviously know that I want to say something to Rabbi Freundel. I'm not going to answer every issue he raised, but I will say I think the gay marriage issue in the United States, I think we have to have blinders on our head not to realize that in 10 years there will be gay marriage all over the United States. So it's going to become a moot question. The Supreme Court is going to allow it, and number one. Number two, the question about the whether to have gone through the RCA and the OU, et cetera, to me that sounds like how something dies in committee. Unfortunately, big organizations like that, which have such a wide swath of rabbinic views, often I believe a statement like this would have been watered down to the point of meaninglessness. And we included a broad range of people, including people who are not modern Orthodox, to comment on the statement, including, I didn't mention, also homosexual Jews who are part of the Orthodox community. And the consensus of the people who wrote the document was that sometimes we need both an establishment and a little bit of a counter-establishment to push the establishment. And I think that's, in certain things, a positive phenomenon. Directly to the question.
Can you dialogue on that before you get to your question? With respect, I'll say two things about this. Number one, I think probably in 10 years the likelihood is in many places in America, though not in all, this will be true, there are very conservative states. But the statement came out now, not then. The second thing I would say is the RCA has several statements that have been passed at conventions on homosexuality that reflect these values. not as comprehensively as what you wrote, not as thoroughly as what you wrote, but I can show you five things that have been there because I've been part of them. They weren't as comprehensive as this. I think you're, in this case, look, I believe me, I'm an officer of the RCA, and it, some days the frustration level when I wake up in the morning is like, you know, can I send in my resignation letter fast enough? But I think on this issue in particular, the RCA does not have a bad record. I think, and the OU does not have a bad record. I think if you had tried that direction, even for a little while, you might have succeeded. And then if you found that you couldn't get there, fine. But I think there are at least four or five. You can look on the website. You can find a number of statements. So with respect, I don't think that's correct.
So to address Dr. Malamud's question directly, you know, it's funny. It struck me when you were asking the question. I assume the same question, obviously, Lahavdil Elif Avdalos, could be asked to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Yisrael Salanter, it's all in the Torah. What do you need a Musar movement? Right. Clearly, he felt that even though it says in the Torah, Lo sisna sachicha bilvavecha, v'yahavta recha kamocha, somehow in the broad swath of Jewish history, certain things had been de-emphasized and not emphasized enough. And the Chafetz Chaim felt Lashon Hara is in the Torah also, but he decided to make a career out of pushing the... Now, I'm not making a career out of this, but I think we can't deny that... While it's not acceptable in Orthodox circles or in Orthodox, in Orthodox schools for someone to get up and berate a yasom and an almana or a ger, even though that also,
happens anyway.
Unfortunately, it happens, it's very common for kids to tease each other, you're a fag. It's very common for rebbeim, I've heard with my own ears, to say things which are out of place. I'm not going to repeat them here. It's very common to hear, just like you hear, unfortunately, racism and other things. There's a lot of issues that, unfortunately, even people who are from a Yidden don't live up to the highest standards of kavod abrios and dignity of human beings. And as I said before, I don't think the statement would have come out if not for the reaction to the panel, which was in many ways so over the top by some rabbinic figures related to Yeshiva University. And many of us felt that that was the picture that was being portrayed, that the real, authentic, orthodox response to kids and adults who speak about their homosexuality and their pain and is, no, you shouldn't be talking about this in public. No, you have no place if you're public about it. You have to be totally discreet. And if you in any way, shape, or form talk about your honest what you're doing, you have no place, and you have to get reparative therapy. That was the underlying tone. We felt at that point it was, even though there's many other issues on the, you know, I think it's a straw man, straw question, in the sense that, yes, of course, there are other issues, but this was the issue that we related to right now because of the reality. In Yirtz Hashem, we won't have to talk about this. We'll talk about other things that need tikkun. That's, I think, the answer, the gadol, to your question.
Just moving slightly from that, then, when you talk about other issues, everybody has priorities in terms of time, energy, and so forth. There are a lot of issues that communities face, many issues that people talk about all the time and wondering, you know, let's play devil's advocate for a second. Why isn't there a statement of principles on shiduchim, on treatment of single women who are unmarried over 35, on tuition, on, you know, et cetera, on and on and on and
there
on
aren't.
And on. Right, right.
There aren't?
Well, in other words...
Every other conference is about
right.
The shidduch crisis.
True, but it seemed like this was a kind of formalized response that required a special document. So I guess that was part of the sort of reaction was, we don't have special documents for these other things. And that's sort of what went into that.
I think each issue is dealt, you know, has to be taken on its own merits. And it's, I personally, I don't know about you, but I've had shidduch, you know, overload. You know, at least in New York, every other day, there's some statement or some organization, you know, they're giving money for people who make shidduchim. They're, you know, the Star K gives out money if you make shidduchim. And this one has a crisis. And the Young Israel has... It didn't seem to me uh-huh. that this was an issue that the OU and the Young Israel were going to be in the forefront of right now for political reasons because it, you know, there whatever issues there are. And so we wrote a statement. We thought very long and hard. We shared it with other people. We also, it was a very, unfortunately, the summer has You know, after we released the statement, the reality of kids who commit suicide and bullying has obviously come to the fore, and unfortunately, this is a real issue. It's obviously not the highest priority for a family and kids who are struggling with it. Yes, it is, but it's one part of what we do. I don't spend my time, you know, I'm not the head of the LGBT coalition of rabbis. That's not, you know, I spend my time teaching Ksuvis and Sefer Bereishit and training rabbinical students and teaching kids on my spare time when I'm not being a father to my kids. So we did this together. So I think it's a little bit overdone to say that this is what we spend all our time on.
Rabbi Frondell, I wanted to ask you about, you raised the issue of shul policy, and there are a number of test cases here that interest me. And since you're talking about don't ask, don't tell, I'm wondering if you see the distinction here as private and public. In other words, if things are known or overtly communicated or not. Test case: two homosexuals in a publicly acknowledged relationship come to shul. Is there any issue about aliyot? Is there an issue about kibudim? Is there a difference between the announcement of it or the non-announcement of it? I'm just trying to get clear here.
I think there is a difference between how public they are. Again, Rabbi Helpkos is right. I would give an aliyah to somebody who's not Shomer Shabbos, so same thing. But there is the following difference. If you come into shul and talk about the joys of, I don't know, going to the ballet or going to a movie Friday night, if you come into shul and you talk to people, encourage people, or talk to people about the wonderful stuff that you're doing that violates Shabbat, I have a problem with that. I'd go over to the person and say, look, it's your life, but, you know, don't bring it here. It's the same thing in this. Now, you asked the case. I had this case. There were two women in my shul. I had several of these, but this is the most obvious, who were very publicly together, particularly because one of them had just divorced her husband, and this was her reason for doing so. They lived, not in my community, the divorced couple, but close enough that everybody in the world knew. And they came to the synagogue, and they asked me, can we come? I said, you're certainly welcome to come. They said, we want to become members. I said, single membership. You can each take single membership. They got involved in the sisterhood, and for 3 years, we were very important people in the sisterhood. But what I said to them was, look, please, don't discuss the homosexual issues in shul, except in the context of if we have a program, if we have something learning. You can raise, you know, those issues then. And it worked fine, and they were happy with doing so, and they were there until eventually they moved away. I didn't have any problem with that. That fits in with what I wrote. I think it fits in with the guidelines here. And I think that's basically what the answer is. You don't bring something which is anti-halachic and advocate for it in the synagogue, whatever the anti-halachic thing. It's not different for homosexuality than it is for Shabbos or Kashrus or anything else. I would have trouble if somebody was talking about the joys of the latest non-kosher restaurant they went to and how great it was. It's not particularly any different. That's what I tried to say in the article. The article didn't address the military, but Norman Podhoretz, who was the editor of commentary in those days, when this issue came up in the Clinton administration, distributed my article, he didn't even ask me, he told me afterwards, to the Joint Chiefs, and based on what they read in the article, they made the don't ask, don't tell policy. Am I totally happy with that policy? I'm not sure I am. I'm just trying to tell you that our conversations about this have had an impact in sort of larger context. And it's a question, as I say, and I say it to Nathie again, I'll say it again, it's a question of what strategy you use to deal with a sensitive issue. I completely agree with Rabbi Helpkos that this is an issue that needs to be addressed. And to say, well, there are more important issues, and to say the Torah, I think that's absolutely wrong. I think it has to be addressed precisely, not only for the reasons that he says. You hear these attitudes periodically appear in many different venues, in many different ways, and I think educating people as to what an appropriate Torah stance is on this is absolutely critical. The question, again, my only disagreement is how you do it. Aside from,
I just want to comment. I agree with the sentiments Rabbi Frondell raised, and I just would go a step further. I agree. You know, if somebody came into shul and advocates, he wants to change the shul into a non-Shomer Shabbos shul, that's one thing, as opposed to somebody, who is not Shomer Shabbos, drives the shul or whatever, or jangles their, the old-time, guy who used to jangle his money. I think that, that type. I think there is just a slight issue about exactly where we might draw the line. I think some of what the question of don't ask, don't tell is how far do we go with that don't ask, don't tell? Meaning, does a person have to live a closeted life to be part of an Orthodox shul? A person's not flaming, he's not Steve Greenberg advocating to change halacha. But he He wants to come to the shul with his partner. And he doesn't want to have to live a lie that this is my friend. Or when someone tries to set him up, he doesn't say, I'm busy. He wants to say, I'm gay and I'm not, you know. That's, I think, part of the issue that gay kids and teenagers and adults, etc., that's the question, I think. And there might be, in some shuls, there'd be different. But I think that that's part of the struggle here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a very difficult question. Although, saying, this is my partner, I'm gay, he's in a homosexual relationship, I don't know, is that really, if you're going to make it the same as Shabbos violation and kosher right. violation, is that not the same as saying, oh yeah, I'm going from shul to a non-kosher restaurant? And if you and so therefore, you know, I have some trouble with that, sort of endorsing that and saying, oh, that's okay. So it's I'd rather not be talked about there. But it raises a question, because once you start making distinctions, oh no, this is much more personal, you're opening the door to, frankly, the kind of discrimination that you're fighting against,
right.
and I hope we're fighting against. These are not simple questions, which again is one of the reasons why I prefer the idea of nuanced articles rather than even a nuanced statement, which you did, because in a statement you can't write a 20-page statement that you send out to the public, because you can't put all the nuances in. And that's another reason why I'm not thrilled with the public statement on this. But again, like I say, I don't think there's much difference where in terms of, you know, how we see these issues. And this problem, I'll just repeat, I have had homosexual couples in the shul. I think everybody knew. But they were told, look, you don't have to have a whole discussion about that in the shul. Everybody knows, you know, you're walking home together. Everybody knows where you live. But don't make it an issue within the shul's context.
If we take that one step further, you're all familiar with the recent controversy in New Jersey and the New Jersey Jewish Standard. There was a printing of a wedding announcement involving two Jewish men, and then after there was an outcry from the Orthodox rabbinate in New Jersey, they then printed a statement saying they would no longer print such announcements of gay unions, which then inevitably engendered a new outcry from people who were very upset that they made the second statement, and so on. But here we're getting another aspect of the same issue, the notion of publicizing. How do you feel about, for instance, publications announcing, you know, this kind of thing?
I mean, if I was in control of the publication and it's an Orthodox publication, I have hesitations. I think, this comes up in the shul context, in the newspaper context. Right. How do you say Mazel Tov the Shabbos before the gay marriage? Assuming, I mean, I don't know how you do it in Toronto, right? You say announce it in the shul, have a kiddush in shul. When you have a bar mitzvah, are we going to have aliyah? Shlishi is to daddy one and Revi is to daddy two, and we announce it that way? I think, frankly, you might do it. We live in an era where these questions come up all the time. I know it's not exactly the subject, but I'll tell you something I had in my shul. I had a woman in my shul got pregnant out of wedlock and told everybody, and everybody knew who the father was. There was a guy who was around who visited, and then she had the baby. We had a two-hour meeting as to how to word the Mazel Tov announcement in the Shabbos announcement page. Because on the one hand, we weren't going to not say Mazel Tov. There's a baby that's showing up in shul. It's a Jewish baby. On the other hand, how do you put in the relationship between the father and the mother of this child, both of whom are known to the shul? And I don't remember what we came up with. We satisfied about 90% to the shul, and we had a 10% meltdown on both sides. You know, this is new realities that we're all struggling with. So I would rather not see it because it's an endorsement of it. A community newspaper is under different pressures than an Orthodox newspaper. But from an Orthodox perspective, I think it's a problem to celebrate specifically the union of two men or the union of two women. I think that's a problem. So what do you do with them afterwards is a different question.
So this newspaper is in my community. Uh-huh. It published it before I moved there. As Rabbi Freundel said, it's a community newspaper. So my personal feeling on this issue is that everybody was disingenuous. Mm-hmm. The newspaper, the Reform, the Orthodox, everybody in this episode was disingenuous because they weren't being forthright and honest. The reality is that even though we all say that other areas of halacha are the same, you know, shomer shabbos, but for some reason, obviously, this is the hot button issue today, and it's sex, and it's really not about sex, but it's about sex, and it's the hot button issue. And it becomes a major issue. And what I mean by everyone was disingenuous, because the newspaper, which is a community newspaper, it's not, you know, it's not the daf shvui of a shul. It's a community newspaper which prints, you know, lobster restaurants and non-shomer Shabbos events left and right. So, and the Orthodox community doesn't bat an eye about that. The rabbis are still part of the rotation of putting the Dvar Torah every couple of weeks where there's a Reform rabbi and an Orthodox rabbi. So, you know, that's disingenuous. But the Reform rabbis were also disingenuous, because I'm sure if the newspaper started publishing intermarriages, there are certain conservative and Reform rabbis who would also go crazy. So everybody was not being honest about that. Yes, there's standards, but what are the standards? And we're not sure. And we have a real tension. And the newspaper was ridiculous. First they retracted, then they unretracted. Then they, you know, you can't be like that. You have to. What they should have done is had a. We need to discuss it as a community. What is a community newspaper? It reminded me very much about 10 years ago during the Israel Day Parade. There was a big fight about the Israel Day Parade, whether the youth group of congregation Bet Simchat Torah, which is a gay congregation in New York, should be allowed to march. And you should have heard the thing. You would have thought it was like, you know, and the Orthodox threatened to pull out all their kids from the state. And I said, it's ridiculous, because, you know, if you allowed for the last 25 years, you know, people to march who, you know, totally are, you know, ideologically different than you, Young Judea and other things, where they encourage the kids to hook up on their trips, you know, and that's okay. So I thought there was a lot of and I think that this is a general issue of what kind of community we're going to have, and we have to together work out boundaries.
Can I comment on that? Because yeah. I was involved in it.
Right.
March. We had had in Washington, D.C. a similar problem, because the gay synagogue had joined the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Orthodox was very upset. And I and one other rabbi worked out a pshara that held for many years. It's unfortunately now fallen apart. We basically said, look, they're Jews. They should be part of the Jewish Community Relations Council. But in order to avoid the sensitivities, what we want to do is as follows. Let them join an overarching organization. There's something called the Independent Chaburot and Kihilot or something like this. And they will go in as Beit Mishpacha, an interesting name for a gay and lesbian synagogue. They'll go in as Beit Mishpacha, member of this this organization. And it won't say gay and lesbian synagogue. And basically, the council will agree not to take up any gay rights issues, not pro-con. And, you know, for what? Because the claim was they wanted to speak on Israel, they wanted to speak on anti-Semitism. And that pshara held for a good 10, 12 years. So when it started in New York, I got a call, because people knew about this. I said, why don't you use the same pshara? It's called what? Beit Simchat Torah? Yeah, Beit Simchat Torah. Let them march under the banner of Beit Simchat Torah. You don't have to say gay and lesbian synagogue. You don't write down Kihilat Jesh, you're a heterosexual synagogue. So, you know, write Beit Simchat Torah. If the idea is to celebrate Israel, you don't have to rub everybody's face in the fact that they're homosexual. You want to let them go. And that pshara didn't have quite the shelf life as the one in Washington. It lasted 2 days.
Right.
And then it's a big question as to who blew it up first, some of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU or the rabbi of that synagogue. But almost simultaneously, you got from the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, this is unacceptable, everybody knows who they are, and you got, we're not going to march under some pseudo-banner. The question is, in some of these issues, if you define what the issue is that you're really looking for and you keep the issue off the table, you might be able to find common space a lot easier than if you have to have it one way or the other. There's no way to split the difference on announcements of a marriage in a newspaper. You're either doing it or not doing it. But if you're marching in the Salute to Israel parade, what's your agenda? You want to march, or you want to march under gay and lesbian synagogue banner? So if they would have kept it in Beit Simchat Torah, and if the guys, the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, had not decided that somehow that was unacceptable, and exactly as Rabbi Helfgott says, they didn't complain about the conservative synagogue that everybody knew was conservative, and they didn't complain about the Reform synagogue that everybody knew was Reform, but this one they complained about. If you can't find that kind of balancing act, then you're really not going to be able to find a common community, in my view. I thought that was a good pshara, except that it wasn't. It didn't work.
I wanted to ask you about principle number 6 and get to what seems to me to be the elephant in the room. It says that Jews with a homosexual orientation within the Orthodox community confront serious emotional, communal, and psychological challenges, great pain and suffering, risk of suicide. Rabbis and communities need to be sensitive and empathetic to that reality. Rabbis and mental health professionals must provide responsible and ethical assistance to congregants and clients dealing with those human challenges. I guess what is ultimately difficult to me about all of this is the notion of words like orientation and sensitive and compassionate. And all this is, of course, true. But the bottom line, the one that I think has to be responded to at some point, is a direct sort of a challenge to the Torah's worldview, right? If you think about current research into homosexuality, quite a bit of it seems to suggest that this is as innate a drive for homosexuals as my heterosexuality would be to me. It seems to me that that's obviously an arguable point, a debatable point. There's lots of research going on about it. But it certainly has a number of very substantial proponents behind it. So I'm sort of wondering at some level, at some point, what does it mean to be ethically sensitive? A person comes to you and says, I'm homosexual. I am aroused by men. I want to have gay, loving, intimate sexual relationships with men. Period. It's not an orientation. It's nothing that you need to be sensitive to. This is who I am. The Torah puts a wall in front of that and says, if you do this, if you commit this act, it is a grave offense, it is toeva, it is whatever adjective you want to do. I'm not quite sure, beyond sort of being nice, whatever that means, where it goes from there. There's a certain wall that you hit. A wall that I think Steven Greenberg tried to climb. I don't think he climbed it well. I thought the book was flawed, deeply flawed. But in other words, he's actually putting the elephant directly in the room. So I'm not sure, we can talk all we like about being nice and being sensitive and working out Aliyot and so forth, but where do we go when we hit that door?
Look, I think, I think the document, as I said, tries to thread the needle in the fact that we have many different points of view out there in the community. The document is very honest, and it says in a couple of paragraphs later that the majority of mental health professionals today do not believe that the average gay person can change, and reparative therapy is seen as unethical and ineffective and sometimes dangerous. And the statement says that. On the other hand, there is a percentage of the mental health community and the rabbinic community also that believes that there are people who can change. And so therefore, we try to thread the needle, not to simply make a blanket statement without any qualifications, nuance, number one. Number two, I think it doesn't, from the point of view of the Torah, it doesn't really matter, ultimately, on the legalistic level, on the ethical, kind of meta-ethical level, that's a legitimate question that has to be addressed by philosophers, etc. But even if one believes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created people, a percentage of the human beings with innate desires for this, yet we live prescribed by the narrative of the law, which tells us that there are certain drives that a person has to be willing to sublimate and hold back from. That's what the law says. And given that conundrum, that's where the sensitivity, the openness... Now, if we lived at a time of the Sanhedrin that could reinterpret verses because of other halachic values that they would then use as part of their exegesis, whether it's, you know, quod abrios or other things, which they would then take into their interpretive process as part of how they interpret certain verses to neutralize. So we could imagine that in a world of a Sanhedrin with the power to engage in drushos like they did to, Ben Sora Morer or Irhani Dachas or other things. Maybe. I don't know. But we don't live in that world. That's not the world that we live in. And so we live in a world where we are faithful to the halacha and the halachic process, and at the same time are torn by this. And that's what this document tries to do. It cannot answer that wall. It can't honestly answer that wall that I, as a homosexual, this document is not Natty Helfgott personally. Natty Helfgott might have written it a little bit differently. And I did originally write it differently. I would have been even stronger about how reparative therapy is how reparative therapy is not to be encouraged. I would have been stronger about certain other things. But it's a committee of 150 people who had input into it. But I personally, I very strongly, from my study of sexuality and the world and people, I believe sexuality is a spectrum, where there are people on one spectrum, and most people have different motivations, different urges. And that's why people sometimes experiment at certain times in their life and then move on. I think that's the reality of sexuality. So That's what I would try to answer you, Bigadol. But I don't think you have, we don't have a good answer except empathy to someone who says, I want to be in a loving relationship. And I understand that if the shoe was on the other foot, if you told me that I couldn't be,
exactly.
If, you know, there's a famous Star Trek episode, Star Trek The Next Generation, where everybody is, the norm is to be gay, and the quote-unquote abnormal is to have feelings for the other side. It's a wonderful episode. And yeah, I don't know how I could handle it. And yeah.
There's a lot in what Rabbi Helfgott said that I want to comment on. Let me start first of all with the fact that in the article that I wrote, I took on this question in much larger terms than in the Statement of Principles. I have a section in which I talk about the theological difficulty of this. And I quote a Gemara that says, "Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba b'tronion barav." God doesn't play tricks on his creations, which is effectively the question that you're asking. He created me this way. How do I do this? I don't know that I come up with a better answer. I'm just saying you can't get there. But the truth is, we do discuss it. On this issue of changing orientation, and we have somebody in the back who I think is going to agree with me because you've been disagreeing with Rabbi Helfgott. Part of the problem that you have is that this issue, like so many scientific issues, has become politicized. And what's happened is it's very difficult to speak to the science of this and to do research in trying to find some other way that might change an orientation other than reparative therapy, because there are those reports of its negativity, is almost, I mean, it's not allowed in many quarters. I will say this, and I've mentioned it many times, I mentioned in my article, there is a Masters and Johnson study that shows a 74% success rate over 5 years of changing orientation of male homosexuals. And what I've mentioned this many times, what I usually get is, oh, that's been challenged. And for years, I have said to people who said that, okay, show me the research. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. Show me the articles that say so. And people do not come up with that. The best I've gotten is a couple of articles that try to show that you can't change it, but not the challenge to that research, and not to the other 10 articles that I now have that say that there is a possibility, at least in some people, to change orientation. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm not a psychiatrist. But what I will say is that the research to try and find out whether it's true or not has been stifled, and it's not out there. And that's an issue. And it really goes back. And this was, I mean, this is really where I have, I think, a fundamental difference with Rabbi Helfgott. This idea that, well, the Sanhedrin might have changed it, and maybe we would have had a different thing. The question is, do you come at this as something which is fundamentally fine, or do you come at this as something which is fundamentally not fine? And it doesn't mean that if you take the position that there is something fundamentally not okay with homosexual sex and homosexual relations, that means that gives you any license to bash people or treat them badly or treat them with disrespect and all the rest. But as I read the Torah, at least, the Torah seems to say that this is something that is intrinsically a bad thing. And if you start from that perspective, then you approach some of these questions somewhat, even the question of your wall, somewhat differently. Then what you have is a huge clash between the contemporary values and the values that Torah expresses. And guess what? That's happened before. And I'll give you an example that always intrigues me. In the Greco-Roman world, the idea of circumcision was an anathema. They believed in the fundamental beauty of the body, and that was considered mutilation of that which was beautiful. And it shows up in the Hanukkah story. It shows up in the whole rise of Christianity. It shows up in other places. Were we supposed to have given up circumcision because that was against the zeitgeist, the morality of the day, the views of the day? I don't think so. I think there are certain places where Jews are just countercultural, and it's not easy, and it's not pleasant, and it's not nice, and you don't want to have to do that. But the bottom line is, we just have different values. We don't have to reflect the rest of the world. Which, again, I say that with no mitigation of the commitment that I have to the principles here that say, you have no right to bash, you have no right to demean, you have no right to degrade, you have to be accepting, all of those things. I'm just as committed as I was before I made that statement, which is committed to that.
I just want to nuance my nuance.
Okay.
Because I think, Robert Frindell, I think that I don't agree with your formulation as follows. Because when I mentioned the Sanhedrin, when the Sanhedrin or Chazal mitigated certain explicitly halachic statements, it wasn't because they were trying to say, oh, Ir HaNidachas is a great thing. Or Ben Sora Mora. Yeah, we'd really like all our kids to be Ben Sora Mora. You make this false dichotomy, which I don't accept, that if a person believes, I don't know what the Sanhedrin will do. Of course, as I said in my opening remarks, the Torah values You know, al ken yazov isha taviv et imo vayulu basar achad is the ideal. A heterosexual marriage that results in children is the ideal expression of sexuality. And there's no doubt about it. And family is the cornerstone of everything. At the same time, and the Torah definitely views homosexual sexuality for all kinds of theological reasons. You know, what's his name? Prager wrote an 80-page essay about why homosexuality is bad, whatever it is. I'm sure that that's correct. At the same time, there are other halakhic values, which is what drove the Sanhedrin to limit some of the reality of Ben Sora Mora, because it conflicted with other halakhic values, like Tzalom Elokim, Kvod HaBrios, other things, whether it was in Ayin Tachas or other things. And so it doesn't mean that you're trumpeting Ben Sora Mora if you limit some of the fallout of it. And the same thing, if the Sanhedrin in its wisdom one day will decide to limit some of the fallout from the explicit reading of certain verses, it will be driven by internal Jewish ethical concerns, which I don't think is a bad thing. So
I don't think it's a bad thing either. And in fact, I think you don't need a Sanhedrin for that. I would hope my article did some of this. I think your statement of principles did some of this. I don't think you need a Sanhedrin for it. But that's different than sort of looking at it and saying, well, ultimately, you know, this is really fine and the Torah's prohibition is really not. Because it gets to this idea of the Torah's prohibition not being not right. Now, this is something you use here in Yidachas and Ben Sora Mora. This is something I've always been fascinated about. You look in the Gemara. Gemara says, "Lo hayav lo niver," and then along comes somebody and says, "What do you mean? I raisi asavi, ashafti al kibra, raisi asavi, ashafti al tila. I saw one. I sat on the grave. I saw one. I sat on the mound." So do we think this guy's a liar? I don't. I think this is part of a general principle in halacha that single exceptions are not things that you have to take into consequence. That in effect, it could happen. In fact, it may have even happened. Maybe on oddball occasions it did happen. But it wasn't, it was a mio cheno matzo, if you want to use a halachic term. But it meant that the possibility of it was still there. In other words, I think that his statement was factually true. It did happen. But I think it's still lo hayav lo nivra because it was so rare, which means they didn't get away from the principle entirely. They didn't remove it entirely. It was still there. It was still within the realm of possibility. And I'm concerned, I don't think this is what you mean, but I'm concerned that it could be taken to say the idea is we have to get away from the principle entirely.
I'm aware of the time, so I did want to open up the floor to questions for the time remaining, if there are any. Yes, sir. I think we're going to wait for you to say it into the mic, okay? So we're just going to bring the microphone, and thank you.
Thank you. My name's Joseph Berger. I'm a psychiatrist, Distinguished Life Fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. I would divide your paper into two parts. Rabbi Helft got the first three quarters, let's say, in terms of the acceptance, the tolerance, the understanding. It's fine. I have no problem with it whatsoever. I have an enormous problem with the last portion in terms of the whole question in terms of treatment and of help. The big problem that I have is that you're very discouraging. I think that that's inaccurate scientifically. It's inaccurate clinically. You've been talking about reparative therapy. I don't do reparative therapy. I don't know people personally. I know of them, but I don't know people who do the sort of work that I do, and I published my first paper on this issue in terms of treatment back in 1994, I think it was, so it's quite some time ago, and have seen many people since then and worked with them successfully. And the approach that I use is a very traditional psychodynamic psychotherapy. Reparative therapy has been given a bad name by people who are working towards a particular gay agenda, I think. The facts of the matter are, as Rabbi Freundel said, the scientific understandings in terms of the literature do not support any sort of innate, genetic, anatomical, or any other inborn biological determination of homosexuality. Exactly what causes homosexuality is still very much open to discussion, but there's no doubt whatsoever that a certain proportion of people who voluntarily come because they want to can be treated successfully and can become comfortably heterosexual. There's lots of research on it. There's lots of good quality stuff that's been published in the literature again and again and again.
Okay.
So it's more in terms of a comment to set the matter straight, because I think that what you've been doing is, unfortunately, it's discouraging. It's discouraging to the people who do want to change for their own reasons, and can a portion of them can be helped in terms of change. Thank you.
Other questions from the floor? Over here.
I'm neither a POSIC nor a psychologist, but when I read this statement, I felt uneasy. And I express myself that way. I admit that the statement makes clear that the Torah law and the Torah attitude toward homosexuality and the nuclear Jewish family. I admit that. But a sympathetic consideration of the problem at our time when, as Rabbi Frendel pointed out, the homosexuality community is so aggressively pushing for being in the front row and having accepted homosexuality as a legitimate alternate lifestyle is quite different from other times when they weren't in the front row. That's point number one. Point number two, what influence does it have on our children who read all this, to see it on television, in the media, and on internet? We are talking here about treatment of people who already have homosexuality tendencies. But what about those who are being induced into it by the publicity and the aggressive attitude that is being shown? That makes it very difficult. And thirdly, our whole existence as Jewish people depend on birth and new little Jews in this world. And the homosexual couples certainly endanger, along with assimilation and intermarriage, our very existence. And that makes me, at this point, very uneasy. And to be specific, I would not accept in our shul somebody who blatantly shows up, this is my partner, and that's what I insist on. This public declaration, to me, is unacceptable as an Orthodox Jew.
I'd like to have a comment on just one part of what you said, particularly with our friend, the local psychiatrist here. When I did the research and talked to the psychologists and psychiatrists that I spoke to and asked about changing the orientation, I think it was before reparative therapy was even used as a term, what they said to me was that it was possible, but that there were variables. The earlier the onset of actual homosexual activity, the more frequent the homosexual activity had actually been engaged in, the more difficult it was to change. I don't know if you find the same thing, but that's at least what was said to me. I think the one part that I would pick up on is, as, and I don't believe in the stigma, I'm not changing that, but as the stigma's going away, as more than that, as when you have a young person who expresses any kind of interest at all, there are places where that is encouraged to be acted on, encouraged to be supported. The likelihood of finding more and more people who start earlier and who have more frequent encounters, which therefore making it harder to change, if those psychologists and psychiatrists are right, I think is a very real one. So that if this is, again, anecdotes don't mean a whole lot. I'm only telling this for the point that I'm trying to make. I had a woman who worked for me for a while as my secretary who would have described herself as gay for 13 years. 8 of those years she had one partner, the other 5 she had a series of partners, and then she changed. And I asked her about it. It was actually when I was writing this article, and she said, I feel like I grew up. I feel like, you know, it was an immature phase that I was in. Well, the interesting thing is if there's any truth to that with any segment of the homosexual population, I'm not trying to make this a general statement out of one. I think it is true in some. If we've created this opening, encouraging to act on atmosphere, and I don't mean we've done it in the halakha community, that's not what I'm saying, but if the world has, then I think it becomes harder to change, and it goes back to what I said before.
If you view this as being perfectly fine, then what I said shouldn't be a problem to anybody. If you view this as being a problem and something negative, then what I said should be a problem to you. And I think it tests down to the bottom level attitude of, is this a question? Is this something that we see as immoral and wrong? Though, I think, you know, Shabbos violation is wrong, but we're still tolerant and concerned and involved. Whether we see that something's ultimately right, and we don't really quite know why the Torah says it's negative. That's a real fundamental values clarification in this. And I obviously associate myself with one side. But I've seen writings in the Orthodox community that suggest the other view. It's a hoax. There's no real immorality here. It's not really something which is wrong. I've seen writing like that. That writing troubles me.
I'll just make a few comments. I think the genie's out of the bottle. This statement doesn't encourage encourage more. The reality is, as Mr. Rothschild said, we live in a world that's radically different than the 50s when Rock Hudson had to be closeted, etc. It's not going to change, and that train left the station a long time ago. We live in a world where gay characters are very sympathetic on TV, etc., and because it's reality of the world in which we live in. And we're going to experience that more and more. And Rosh Yeshivas are going to have children and grandchildren who are going to be gay, and shul presidents, and heads of Mizrahi. I mean, it's going to happen. And that's the reality in which we live in. So I think that we can't go back. We can make believe we can go back, but like so many other things, we can't go back in the world to that reality. It's just not happening. We are inundated with a sexual openness, and that is just, and you said, look, Canada, which is in many ways I always thought Canada is a very conservative with a small C society, on this issue they're 10 years or 20 years ahead of the United States in the civil society. So that's the reality of what's going on, and I don't think the statement changes that any way, shape, or form. As I said before, again, now I'm talking personally, not as the author of the statement, I said that I believe that sexuality is a spectrum. And I believe that there are people who experiment in college, in high school, who experiment with different types of sexuality, who are bisexual. And that's a reality of the world. And I'm sure that there are percentage of people who aren't fully homosexual and, quote unquote, can change or decide to be monogamous with one person as opposed to with. But I also believe very strongly that there are people who are born that way. And I don't know what the percentage is, and who will not change, whether it's reparative therapy or other therapies. And in discussing with many other psychiatrists, I respect your own experiences, but there are many others who disagree, and certainly with the people who've experienced that. And I'm talking about from psychiatrists, which, who didn't come with any agenda to the issue. So I think the question about children being induced, again, it's a reality of the world in which we live in that they see in the television and the internet and the movies. And, that's a challenge. And whether we say this or not is not going to change that. And I think that will affect people in college who want to experiment. I also do think that we have to be careful not to overdo that, the children being induced. I'm not an expert. I didn't read all the research. But if I'm not mistaken, and tell me if I'm wrong, but the research that I read is that children who grow up with gay parents are not any more likely to be gay than children who didn't grow up. The percentage.
No, it's inconclusive.
I'm sorry?
He's shaking his head no, and as I read it, it's inconclusive.
My point is that there is no conclusive. So the idea, and that's certainly a situation which is the greatest inducement. I don't know how we're going to handle it in the future, but this isn't going to go away. And simply to put our head in the sand is not going to make it go away.
There'll be one more question.
This is not so much a question, but a response to some of the things that were said by Rabbi Friedel and Rabbi Helfgott. The issue that we're talking about came up as a result of the symposium that was held last December 21st, and the title of the symposium was Being Gay in the Modern Orthodox World. The statement of principles that was as a result of this that came out 6 months prior. Bear in mind the topic of the discussion was... Bear in mind, the topic of the discussion held at Wurzweiler School was being gay in the modern Orthodox world. So in terms of your comment about gay marriage here in Canada, that it's legal, gay marriage in Canada is a civil event that is not the concern of an Orthodox gay person. What the Orthodox gay person wants is acceptance by the Orthodox community. He doesn't really care about the issue of gay marriage on the civil level. Number two, you talk about kashrut, you talk about Shabbos observance. Kashrut is a choice. Shabbos observance is a choice. Circumcision, back into the times of Hellenistic times, was a choice and still is a choice. But being gay is not a choice. Number three, maybe reparative therapy works, maybe it doesn't work, but there are many cases where reparative therapy fails to the point where it leads to suicide. And one life lost is one life too many in our Jewish community. Finally, to answer the issue that was raised before, the agenda of the modern Orthodox person is not to turn other children into gays. This is not Glee. All he wants to do is be accepted as a modern Orthodox Jew in the Jewish community, period.
With respect, I think that a number of those points don't relate to what I said, and I think that they're in some ways wrong. I didn't say that gay marriage or the presence of gay marriage was about the Orthodox community. I said that that was about the idea of having a public statement that went way beyond the Orthodox community. Because the issue in America is gay marriage, it's being fought every day, this public statement played into that. And most in the gay community were unhappy. Many in the gay community were unhappy about it because it didn't grant gay marriage, and it was seen as a pushback, as a setback. Which is, that's the point that I was trying to make.
Okay, please, it's still on.
That was a point that I was trying to make. So, that's not about the Orthodox community. It's first of all. Second of all, I'm sorry, with respect, if you define homosexuality as activity, not a state of being, it's very much a choice. You're telling me that gays are forced to have sex? If they do, they have a serious, anybody who's compelled to have sex has a serious psychological problem. The definition that I try to use that is in this statement as well is that the issue for halakha is activity, not thought, not desire. Desire may not be a choice, but whether you act on the desire is a choice. I might have a desire for lots of women, but I'm married. I might have a desire for lots of other things, but I can't do it. It's a choice as to whether I do it. It's not a choice as to your feelings. And that's where the fundamental definitional point between gay as a state of being and homosexual activity, that's where the difference is and where the choice comes in. And I have to tell you, the definition of gay is very problematic. I have gay feelings, but I never acted on them. Does that make me gay? Well, in the scientific community nowadays, they would say yes. I don't think so. Right? I have gay feelings. I acted on it once in college. I never did it again for the next 30 years. Am I gay? Maybe. Not according to what I was saying. You did one thing that was wrong. So the choice aspect is not in the feeling. It's in the behavior. So again, that's always thrown. I was not there. On the therapy thing, and this is a question for Rabbi Helfgott as well. If you accept the idea that there are some people on the fence who might be led into this because of the more accepting attitude, even if there are some who are, you know, they can't ever change, then we have a burden to try and figure out some way how to deal with those and keep those involved and keep those not violating halakha. And the question is, how do we address that? And I don't think that the gays in the Orthodox community are trying to seduce kids. It's not the suggestion. But the more acceptable you make it, the more open to it you make it, the more and it's not modern Orthodox types, the more the society says to someone who expresses homosexual ideas, even a little bit, oh, you know, act on that, work that out, the more you're going to get into what the psychiatrists have told me. The younger you start, the more often you did it, the harder it is to change. And again, it goes back to what I said. Either it's good or it's bad. I think it's bad, and that's why it becomes a problem.
I want to thank everybody for coming together for this session. Thank you very much.